You're listening to Pollinate, a podcast on data, design, and the people that bring them to life. Brought to you by Stamen Design.
Petro Future Maps, Speculative Cartography, and GeoBreakfast. These are a few of the things we talk about in today's episode. I'm Stephanie May, the Director of Geospatial at Stamen. I had the opportunity to sit down with the brilliant mapmaker behind the website conspiracyofcartographers.com to talk about how he grapples with the looming threat of climate change through playful satire and imaginative cartography. Please welcome my guest.
Jeffrey Lin, and I have my studio, Conspiracy of Cartographers, where I make maps and mapping mashups sort of things. I actually really hate titles, so I tried to give myself a fun one. I call myself a speculative cartographer because the most interesting work that I do is set well into the future. And it's really along the lines of speculative fiction. It's speculative cartography. And I thought I had coined it at the time, but turns out other people use that for themselves as well.
There are other speculative cartographers in the world, you're saying?
I've found them in the sort of the fantasy mapping realm. There are a lot of folks there.
And what is that thing? Can you put your finger on, you make the analogy between speculative cartography and speculative fiction, and I think that's quite evocative, but are you able to, as you described that there are other speculative cartographers in the fantasy maps realm, do you have any, can you describe any more what speculative cartography might mean?
Well, for me, it's creating more of a science fiction vibe. For others, it's more of a fantasy vibe. I mean, what I try to do is I take real world data, and for my speculative cartography, I take elevation information and project like sea level rise based on what scientists have predicted would happen if all of the world's ice caps were to melt. For me, that's the speculative aspect of what I do.
Makes a lot of sense. Yeah. We both spent some time in the San Francisco Bay Area, you more so than me. So why don't you just talk a little bit about your background, how you ended up where you are now?
Yeah, the whole Bay Area thing. I was born in Walnut Creek, but I didn't actually live there. About 25 miles east of San Francisco. But I didn't live there. I lived in this tiny town called Oakley, which is way out there. And now is kind of the sprawling suburb. It used to be farms and ranches and things. And now it's like golf courses and suburbs, which is kind of heartbreaking. But I moved around a lot when I was a kid. I lived in a few places in the Bay Area, and then Lake Tahoe, Reno, Phoenix for a few years, the Coachella Valley, and then this town where my dad always lived, also east of San Francisco, called Antioch. Another, you know, kind of, it's very close to Oakley, very sprawling suburb. And then when I got to be an adult, I moved to San Francisco and went to San Francisco State and studied geography there and a bunch of other things, and ended up in geography. And you did too.
Yeah.
That's cool. It's always nice to run into another alum from SFSU.
We have San Francisco State University geography in common. I did my graduate work there in the 2010 era. And one mystery that I think we're still working on resolving that's come up that I think we should share with the listeners is the sign in the upstairs window above the stairwell into the HSS building, into the geography department, just in black and white sign. And it says, "Long live the historic insurgents of Gondwanaland," which is deep in joke for geographers. And you said that sign was there when you were there as well.
Yeah, this was, you know, back in the early 90s. So that sign has been perplexing generations of San Francisco State students. I think it was there for a long time before I was there. Probably goes back into the 80s or 70s even. It's been there a long time. So I was surprised when you sent me that street view link.
Yeah.
That thing is still there. I wonder how many generations of professors have had that office and just left it there.
I emailed the current occupant, who is the chair of the department, but he hasn't gotten back to me. Maybe he will by the time we broadcast this, and we'll post that link to the street view on the blog along with any answers we can get about this sign. But for those for whom Gondwanaland may not ring a bell, it's the name for one of the proto-continents after Pangaea broke up. So it's a deep in-joke because this landform predated humans by quite a lot. Don't know who those heroic insurgents would have been or what the origins of that joke are. May the mystery continue.
Because it was a supercontinent. I guess there have been several supercontinents. I had to look this up because I knew, you know, there's Pangaea, then there's Gondwanaland. I think Pangaea is like the more known one. I don't know. But there have been several of them. I had to look it up, like which one came first. But it was a supercontinent. And I think the old joke, the joke that I heard before I ever saw that sign was reunite Gondwanaland. And that's, I think, a little more understandable if you're aware that there were supercontinents and one was named Gondwanaland.
It does make more sense in terms of landforms and what they might do. But and anyway, would you characterize that sign as a conspiracy of cartographers, or is it just a conspiracy of geographers, or is it not a conspiracy?
Oh, God. I don't know. A conspiracy of geologic time, something along those lines. Yeah.
All right. So talk to me a little bit about your professional work. So you have the Conspiracy of Cartographers studio. You also have a day job. Do the two mix at all, or are they completely separate?
They're pretty separate. I do a lot of cartography at my day job, but it's very different. It's a very different sort of type, style of cartography. Mm-hmm. I work for King County here in Seattle, and I'll be taking on all of the metro mapping, the bus route and transportation mapping, which is fun. I was interested in transportation and still am, but I was really interested in it professionally for a while and did some coursework in that a while back. There was a time when, you know, I was a GIS analyst for a long time and, you know, I almost left the profession. I was just really burned out. I'd been deep in projects that were, you know, kind of meaningless to me and spent a lot of time developing things that in the job that I had at the time wasn't getting a lot of support for, and just a lot of things that were conspiring to just burn me out. And I was just sick of being a GIS analyst. And the thing that saved me from that, actually, you know, in some ways, I think I'm still burned out on that, but it was cartography and shifting my focus from the data and development aspects of geo information to the, in my opinion, much more interesting cartographic aspects. Mm-hmm. And that gave me new life in my career, gave me a second wind. And I've enjoyed my career much more since I started doing that. And that was about 10 years ago when I made the first sea rise map.
Oh, yeah.
And I always knew that my, you know, love of geography and topography and just the physical world needed to manifest itself in some way in geography or in landscape architecture. And I think getting out of just focusing on data and development and into something much more design oriented, something where I could use my aesthetic sense, where I could use my imagination, really sort of saved my career, probably saved my life.
Thank you for sharing that. I think your experience is going to resonate with a lot of listeners who have worked as GIS analysts, have worked in the GIS field. And certainly I can say for the cartographers that I know at Stayman, the journey is pretty common. It's interesting. I feel like in a lot of ways, many of us have reclaimed the title and notion of cartography to describe something a bit more empowered than maybe what a GIS analyst is able to do. Yes, it's about design, but it's also about interpretation and going beyond the tools that you're given to have an opinion, to have a narrative, to have a voice.
Yeah, absolutely. The levels of self-expression that you can really realize in that sort of work. Yeah, it is absolutely empowering to make a map with a point of view.
Yeah, which is interesting when you think really about the history of cartography writ large, right? Cartography has at times in history been the tool of empire. So I think there is this dialectic and this ebb and flow between mapping being something that's done for the sake of, you know, claiming territory or at the cost of perpetuating inequality or creating inequality or creating division, consolidating power, and the other side of it, which I think as cartographers, obviously we want to draw out a lot more in this era, which is around reclaiming and around liberating and empowering.
Yeah, there's so much truth to that. You know, I love old USGS maps. And one of those things that I could just spend days and days and days being distracted by. And the fact that they're all online and you can get them all geo-referenced and everything. And I won't say wasted. I've spent a lot of well-distracted hours looking at these maps. But at the same time, I think it's important to know that these maps were tools of conquest, that these maps were made in an era when there was genocide going on in North America and the United States. And these maps were sort of tools of that. They were tools of resource extraction. They were tools of colonization and settlement. And I think that as geographers, cartographers, that it's important to realize that's where these came from. One of the things that is fascinating is just the number of racial slurs that you'll find in these maps. I mean, everywhere. They're everywhere. And yeah, I feel like, you know, I should do something about this. I don't know if that's like my lane as a white man. Is that something that I could really speak to? But yeah, there's a ton of it out there.
Well, a callback to our February podcast episode, my colleague Alan McConkie interviewed Tanya Rucca of the Native Land Digital Mapping Project. And she had some really, really powerful and poetic things to say about the process of engaging Indigenous communities with mapping territory, mapping space, tying history to land. Every time I think of it, it gives me tingles because, you know, it feels right. It feels like the future that we want as cartographers and as human beings.
I'll have to listen to that one because that's something that really interests me.
Yeah, look for the February episode. That was a really wonderful interview. Coming back to our topics at hand. So you joined me for the first inaugural Geo Breakfast in Seattle last week. What did you think? What do you think of this trend towards in-person gatherings? Are we ready for it?
It was fun. You know, I still take a lot of precautions with COVID because it's still out there. Mm-hmm. And so I generally mask in indoor spaces. But I don't know, I kind of look at it in terms of harm reduction other than elimination. And so I will take calculated risks here and there when I think they're worth it. And that was definitely worth it. And I miss going out in person, you know, going out for coffee, going out for drinks after work. I really, really miss that stuff. I started working from home exclusively 3 years ago. And as nice as it is to just wake up in the morning, have coffee, and not have to spend half an hour, 45 minutes getting from my house to my office, a lot is also lost in just being social and being among other people. And I definitely miss that.
Hear, hear.
So I'm all excited about meeting in person, but I still want to take precautions. They have an outdoor space there, right? So as it warms up, we can move to the sidewalk space.
I think we definitely should. It's still a bit cold in Seattle, but getting sunnier all the time. And absolutely agree with everything you're saying, both the need for ongoing precautions and the need for some calculated risks here and there as we sort of venture out. I was inspired to start this Geo Breakfast here in Seattle because I was a longtime participant in the Geo Breakfast in San Francisco that existed for years and years. Mike McGursky started this tradition when he was still at Stamen, ahead of the State of the Map Conference in Portland in 2011 or 12. And the tradition continued every Friday at this place called the Pork Store Cafe in the Mission. Up until the pandemic, it's still ongoing to somewhat, but it's also online. And for me too, it very much is the right calculated risk to be taking. And we found a wonderful location in Lost Lake Cafe in Capitol Hill, which has some echoes of the diner vibe of the original Geo Breakfast in San Francisco. And we've done two so far. It's been really great. I hope you'll keep coming. We're talking a little bit about bringing in some Twin Peaks vibes, maybe. There already are some Twin Peaks vibes to that location.
Yeah, it has that sort of, I don't know, 60s loungy diner vibe, which I really, really appreciate.
So for our listeners, I have just pulled up a visual of what Jeffrey does so we can dig into it just a little bit more around speculative cartography and sea level rise. Now, I've heard sea level rise maps described as the charismatic megafauna of future projected climate change scenario visualizations. Yeah. That notwithstanding, it still is kind of a best in class example of how we might imagine future scenarios, you know, in the speculative realm. So I would love to just hear you talk a little bit more about this map, this visual that I'm showing. So for those listening, I am putting between Jeffrey and I, was this the first sea level rise map you made of Seattle?
Yeah, this was the first one I made almost 10 years ago. It was different. Actually, I've revised it a few times, but it was basically, it was this extent. And by the way, I love the comparison to charismatic megafauna. I'm going to use that. By the way, I hope you don't mind, because it is the big thing, the thing that is dramatic and gets people's attention. There are a lot of other more subtle things that are equally, if not more damaging, that will happen with climate change, but they don't translate as well to a map. An image like this really, really gets people's attention. It's dramatic and gets people talking, you know, kind of like, what is a good example of charismatic megafauna, you know, like a snow leopard or something that really gets people's attention.
Right. Save the whales. Yep.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that inspired me to do these maps originally, Ursula K. Le Guin did this book back in the mid 80s called Always Coming Home. And it had a map in it that was the California Central Valley after all of the ice caps have melted. And that was an inspiration to me that had been just sort of, you know, moldering in my mind for years and years. And then this guy in the Bay Area in San Francisco, Burrito Justice, made his map of San Francisco. And I thought, oh, that's really cool. I could actually do that for Seattle. And so I did something very similar to what he had done. And it can be a very daunting, very sort of grim topic, but I try to have fun with it. And so I give it place names, the puns, just making fun of the place or making fun with the place, with all of the names that I give the different places.
Yeah, I love the fun that you had with this map. And just kind of stepping back and reflecting on what you're doing here. So you're welcome to use the charismatic metafauna analogy. It's not original. Credit to my colleague Damon for suggesting that one. In addition, though, I think, so you called out, okay, this map, it's relatable. It's attention grabbing. It's dramatic. That's how it's parallel to the charismatic megafauna idea. But in addition, I think one thing, you and I are both in Seattle, living in Seattle right now. So there's also that anchoring that, you know, the one thing that I noticed that everyone does when they encounter a map is they zoom in on where they live, right? Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I think that's one thing that particularly resonates for me about this work that you did and this thing that we have in common. So like, as I'm looking at this and zooming in on some of your names, they resonate especially. So I live on Capitol Island. Do you care to name where you live?
I live on Wallingford Island, just uphill from Nimby Point. That was sort of a pointed dig at a lot of my neighbors, kind of the central Nimby neighborhood here in Seattle.
So if I were transported into this future scenario, I could hop on a kayak, take the Amazon River, depending on the currents, maybe take the Amazon River north to you, which is a very clever play on the South Lake Union area where all the Amazon buildings are.
The actual geographic types that I use here don't always correspond to what the actual thing is, but it just was too much fun to pass up.
Any other clever puns you want to call out in this original piece of work?
Let's see. What's a good one? I'm fond of Lake City Bay because it plays on Lake City Way up there. Isle of Clyde, Isle of Skyway, I think might be my favorite on this one. It's down to the south.
There it is. Wow.
Yeah, I like that one.
Isle of Skyway. That's wonderful because it makes it sound very mythical and beautiful. I'll just leave it there.
Yeah, it has a certain British misty sort of vibe.
Yeah, totally true to life. Totally. I'm looking forward to that Isle of Skyway in some ways compared to what's there now, but we won't dwell. So yeah, thanks for that exploration. So you've moved on a bit and your most recent work is the Petrofuture series. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Petrofuture, I've been having a lot of fun with those. So these are old gas station maps, you know, the type that they used to give out for free when you were traveling cross country, stop at a gas station and pick up a map that showed you the roads of that state or city in this example. And they're real objects, for me anyway, of affectionate nostalgia. These are the sorts of things that when I was a kid, I used to just look over constantly. I would spend hours looking at these maps and just sort of tracing the lines and wondering, ooh, you know, what does this place look like? What would this place be like if I were to visit it? And conceptually, with these maps, I wanted to play with those feelings of nostalgia, because although I have plenty of affectionate feelings of nostalgia for places and times, I do think that those sorts of feelings can get in the way of us making a better world. And so many people, I think, are really stuck in the past. And playing on that NIMBY name that I gave that place in Wallingford in the previous map, people want to preserve a place in time, often that is their childhood or collegiate years. And what we need to be doing is looking forward and changing the world to create less fossil fuel reliance. And so that kind of brings in the whole gas station map, where I wanted to play with nostalgia and sort of poke at the corporations that are perpetuating the systems that we live in. And so that's why I started putting the sea level rise onto these old gas station maps.
Yeah, really well said. What certainly resonates for me about your Petro gas station map work is that simultaneous nostalgia feeling combined with what maps really allow us to do and process and think about, both in terms of space and time. So also, you know, shifting towards the future, the way that you're overlaying that sea level rise, that 66 meter sea level rise that the IPCC has calculated and projected if all of the ice caps melt, I think really allows for that sort of back and forth exploration in a map piece, which is really incredible. So for folks who want to explore these maps more, Jeffrey's done a huge series of them for all sorts of cities. They're on his website, conspiracyofcartographers.com, both the Sea Level Rise series and the Petro Future series, and anything else on there that you would want to highlight, Jeffrey, that folks might enjoy poking at a bit more.
The retro future I had a lot of fun with as well. I mean, mixing up the past with these projections well into the future is just, it's a lot of fun to do. And I've always loved old maps, like so many geographers and cartographers. It's really satisfying to work with these old vintage maps. I do a lot of work with those in the United States. The Petro Future maps, I have to credit the Rumsey Map Center for providing the base maps for those. They actually bought a couple of the California Petro Future maps to put in their collection. That was gratifying. You know, that was really a good feeling to have them do that. But yeah, and some, you know, just sort of random cartographic things are also on there that I've done.
Just to tie it back into the speculative cartography theme, the last thing that I really love about it, that I think is very timely to this moment, is that like speculative fiction, I think speculative cartography gives us this opportunity to process what's happening as we're starting to really feel, I feel like in the last couple of years, the world changing around us. There's something sort of psychically necessary about starting to envision both the future and the past and placing ourselves in it. I found myself reading a lot of near-term speculative science fiction in the last few years, just to try and grapple with what the future might look like. And so I think that your speculative cartography fits really well in that tradition. And I love that about it. And thank you for it.
You mentioned the sort of psychic necessity of seeing where we were as climate change is becoming more and more obvious. I mean, that was something. All of these maps, I think, are really an expression of me kind of working through my own climate change feelings. And it's been really therapeutic for me to be working on these projects. I kind of feel like it's been crucial to my life the past, you know, 5-10 years to work on these things. Just a real good way for me to sort of work out my climate change anxieties. But do you have any recommendations for near-term speculative fiction? I'm always looking for good recommendations.
Well, the classic for me is Octavia Butler, mm-hmm. Parable of the Sower. That series, I think, is quite prescient in a lot of ways. I think there's more in this genre certainly to be written as well, because there's plenty of space travel science fiction and plenty more to say about how the earth might change in our lifetimes and beyond, and what humanity might look like. Thank you for diving right in there and exploring a bit of your work with me. In any case, it's been wonderful talking to you this afternoon. Thanks so much for making time. As we close out, though, I'll ask you one more question, which is any ideas you're thinking of, any ideas you're pondering for future work that you want to share?
Oh, God. You know, I keep a running list of ideas that I may or may not get to. I'm still working my way through some of the petrofuture maps. I'm working on a series, which I've thrown a few out there, silhouette maps. I'm not sure if that's a term, but it's basically two or three colors. Water is one color, land is another color, and then I have streets as like a gray. Mm-hmm. And so they're black and white mm-hmm. and gray of sea level rise for various cities. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was interested in doing a series of maps that have nothing to do with climate change, but I'm interested in maybe doing a series on sacred sites, like especially sort of North American native sacred sites. Mm-hmm. I think that's the latest thing I've added to my idea list that I can get inspired with. And, you know, I mentioned my love of the old USGS quads. I've been working on a map that takes those, you know, late 1800s, early 1900s map styles mm-hmm. and updates them with newer techniques, newer information, but in the same sort of aesthetic spirit as those old USGS maps. That actually feeds into this sort of personal archaeology project where I'm looking at the different places from my childhood, which was all spent in the American West, and mapping those memories out as USGS style map quads. And I actually have been working on this one thing for the past week that does that style. I've created the style in this area north of Pyramid Lake in Nevada. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the basin and range mm-hmm. geographic patterns are so fascinating to mm-hmm. me, because you get these just rugged, jagged peaks and then these flat U-shaped valleys and in sequence across, and they're all like north to south. Mm-hmm. And I just love looking at those patterns. And there are so many remnants there, old mining camps and things like that, that we used to explore when I was a kid. A lot of these are personal projects, like this whole personal archaeology thing.
That sounds amazing. Have you ever read John McPhee, Basin and Range?
God, you know, I've had that on my shelf for years, and I think I cracked it a couple of times, but I never actually read it. But just the title.
Absolutely.
But yeah, the Great Basin geography is fascinating to me, especially having spent a lot of my childhood there.
Right. It absolutely is. The way it's kind of writ large, but like a lot of landscapes in the West, they're just so huge. They're so vast that they're hard to take in.
Yeah, you see them on a map mm-hmm. and it's like, oh, well, that's interesting. There's a mountain range, there's a valley. And once you're in it, it's vast and monotonous. But the monotony is really interesting. It's a really interesting monotony. If you take Highway 50, you can drive from, you know, Lake Tahoe, and then you go immediately down into the basin. And you just go like that for hundreds of miles. And they call it the loneliest highway. And I know why they call it that. I've been there and it's just amazing.
Yeah, it is. And right. And if you have that cartographer sense of what happens when you pan out and you see this just incredible landform, and then if you know the geologic history behind it, how that basin and range land formation forms as the plates are pulling apart, it just, the intrigue increases.
And the fact that it was this massive lake, just Lake Lahontan, the ice age lake, when there was a mile of ice where we're both sitting. There was a massive lake, and to think about it in geological times, there were humans. Mm-hmm. There were humans walking around and paddling around in Lake Lahontan, getting around the glaciers of the north.
I wonder if they were speculating about our future, about the future we're in right now, those humans.
That would be interesting. Yeah, what were their thought processes? Mm-hmm. Things changed more slowly then for humans. And now we're just in this era of constant change, and we have adjusted, I guess, psychologically to that sort of thing. But what would it be like to live in a society where things didn't change, or they changed very slowly mm-hmm. over the course of generations? Mm-hmm. That would be interesting. Sometimes I have a nostalgia for that sort of thing, which I never experienced.
Absolutely. Yeah, very resonant. All right. Well, wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing all of your thoughts, and really looking forward to the continued development of your work, and hope to see you at Geo Breakfast some coming Fridays and to just continue the conversation. Thank you so much, Jeffrey.
Thank you so much, Stephanie, and I will see you at the next Geo Breakfast.
Thank you for listening to Pollinate, and thanks, Jeffrey, for joining us today. This episode of Pollinate was written by Alan McConkie, Damon Burgett, Ross Thorne, and me, Stephanie May. Music for Pollinate was created by Julian Russell. You can find Jeffrey's work, including the retro and petro future maps, on his website, conspiracyofcartographers.com. If you're a fan of Pollinate and the content we put out, please review and subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. More importantly, share the show with your friends and colleagues. If you enjoyed today's episode, tell us on Twitter at Stamen, or on our Mastodon account at viz.social/@Stamen, and tag us using #Pollinate or #PLN8. Remember to keep an eye out for the accompanying blog post at stamen.com/blog, where we'll provide visuals and follow up with updates on the themes and topics Jeffrey and I discussed, and provide you with links in a transcript.